We have been studying the yoga of love and have now arrived at a point where we can take stock of the advantages and the excellences of this way of approach to God over others. We can conceive of a large number of seekers who are not mentally developed enough to tread the path of knowledge. We can also conceive of many who are unable to use their will or develop their will as required for a ceaseless consecration of works to God. But there could hardly be any who do not know how to love. Life and love go together. Everyone, whatever his development, knows spontaneously, instinctively to love. It does not matter what is the quality of this love, to what extent this love is egoistic or self-regarding. But the fact that there is this capacity for love in a human being is enough. One can always start from where one is, even if the love is self-regarding in the beginning. One can always change the character of love. It is in this spirit that Sri Krishna lists among his legitimate devotees. He speaks of four: those who seek him out of distress, those who seek him for objects of desire, those who seek to know him, and the fourth, who know him and love him because they know him. It is a superstition, an ascetic superstition, that a seeker of God shall not pray for the fulfillment of his desires. It is because one has trust, one has the confidence in the Godhead, whether one conceives of the Godhead as the Father, the Lord, or the Mother, that one approaches childlike. And it is a law of spiritual dynamics that the mother soul always welcomes the child soul on whatever plea. Even this prayer to God in trust for the grant of certain wishes or desires forges a link, and the very grant of these desires, which God always does, provided it is in the real interest of the seeker, opens up an avenue for the growth of love. There have been number of instances where people starting with desires have become ashamed of the reasons of their love, and the lower element has simply dropped off. This then is the easiest and the most accessible path to all, the way of love. There is a belief among the so-called intelligentsia, the philosophers, that love for personal God, love for God in a personal form, is an inferior movement, whereas love for the impersonal divinity is of a higher type. But I am afraid, whatever may be the theory, Indian tradition does not support this view. It is argued by these philosophers that when one loves the divine impersonality, the human personality ultimately merges itself and is no more. There is neither the lover nor the loved. There is only love. This sounds very well in words, but in practice, what happens? Even when one starts thinking that the impersonal divinity is a status of being, a state of existence, the question arises, is the existence an inert existence, or has it a consciousness of its own? It is conceded by all that the supreme existence is a conscious existence, and the nature of that consciousness is not only to be self-aware, aware of everything, but to be blissful. This existence that is conscious and is blissful is only a way of positing an existent, a supreme being that is conscious and blissful. This consciousness again has power. It is not inert. And this power of consciousness, or more properly, this consciousness as power, is called in Indian terminology Shakti. All in the universe is a projection, is an emanation from this being, from this power. And this being lends himself to all types of relations to the human soul. Even when one conceives theoretically of the possibility of the human adorer being lost in adoration, neither the lover nor the loved being there anymore, we should remember that this is only an acme of experience. It is not a permanent state. The individual adorer, the lover, the human lover, exists, maybe in the bosom of the infinite, of the ineffable being, but he exists. The being exists to receive and respond. The state of union, the state where there is only one, it is a crown of achievement. But that does not, at no time does it cancel the fact of the individual being being there. I remember once the mother saying that if it was the divine intention that the individual soul is at any time to cancel itself out of existence, to disappear into the bosom of the infinite, it would not have been projected at all. The very fact that an individual soul has been emanated shows that a particular stress in the oceanic being of God wanted to manifest itself, to manifest the glory of the parent divine, and it will continue to do that, whatever the type of intermediate experiences. The individuality, the fact that of an individual existence of a soul, cannot be cancelled. It continues. The person who loves is individual. The person who gets that experience and unity is again the individual. And after the melting of that experience, it is the individual who continues, who remembers, and who cherishes that experience. The Godhead, of which all impersonal existence is a state of being, this is the ideal of the practitioner of the yoga of love. It is not possible to realize the full extent of the being of this Godhead at one stretch. As the individual grows and so extends, the being of the Godhead that reveals itself. That is the law of evolution. As one develops, as one grows, the capacity also to receive more, to understand more, to embrace more and more areas of being develops. The faculty of the mind, the emotions, the will, all the three have to be sedulously cultivated and trained to share in this union of love, in this outpouring of love, in this reception of love from their respective levels. The level of knowledge, the level of emotions, the heart, the level of will. It is to provide for this inability of the human consciousness to grasp all at once the full glory of the divine being, that the divine reveals itself in the form in which the adorer approaches. He reveals himself. He is celebrated in terms of the absolutes of certain qualities, certain powers to which the human consciousness is open. That is what we call in India the Ishta Devata, or the Godhead elect of human nature. Each nature has its own conception of the form in which it would like to approach and realize the Godhead. It has got its own temperament and nature, which alone can respond to identical formulations of the Godhead. These are the various forms in which the divine Godhead has manifested itself, what we call Christ, Krishna, Buddha, Shiva, Vishnu, and so on. Each of these Godheads is a formulation of particular qualities, powers, functions, or principles of the divinity. The aim of the integral seeker is to synthesize all these modes of manifestation of God, know that there is no real conflict between these several self-presentations or self-formulations of the Godhead. They are functional manifestations with appeal at certain junctures of human development. The seeker attempts to universalize, to personalize these elect forms of Godhead. He is not content to experience the particular Godhead whom he adores in his own terms. He seeks to realize the same Godhead in other areas, to see how those Godheads are active in the other forms. First, he realizes that the Beloved is present in himself. One may start with the mental conviction, based or not based upon experience, but upon faith. One dwells upon it, one concentrates upon it, and if one has the grace of God operative directly or through an appointed teacher, not self-appointed teachers, but God-appointed teachers, then one gradually becomes conscious of something within oneself, at the deepest core of one's being, which is somehow different from the rest of ourselves. There is, seated within the heart, in the heart cave, to use the classic expression of the Upanishads, there is the Godhead, there the Lord is seated. One starts with that conception, and with good luck, help of holy company, ascesis, meditation, prayer, concentration, one arrives at this perception of the Godhead. But it is not enough. This is only the first capital step. After one is convinced practically that there is the Beloved, that the Divine Lord is inside, one has to proceed to organize the whole of one's life around him. It will not do to enter into communion with him only during special periods of concentration or worship or meditation. One has to open up all the regions of the being one by one, the mind, the heart, the life energies. And the easiest way to open them and bring them under the rule of the inner ruler is to cultivate the habit of not doing anything, of not acting or reacting to any situation without some reference to the Divine within. In the beginning, one may be misled. In the beginning, one may think one has referred, but the very sincerity of the seeker ultimately tells and draws forth the inmost response. The whole of life becomes a movement proceeding with the sanction of the Lord within. Similarly, those who start with work, work as their means, one works for the God one loves. One starts as a servant of God. One looks into oneself and sees what God would want of him, and to the best of his lights, to his inmost sincerity, what he feels to be the work that has devolved upon him, he does it as a servant. This is the first step, the lowest step for the God lover in the way of work. Gradually, as his will develops and subordinates itself to the higher or the deeper will of God, one becomes an instrument of God. That is the second step. From being the servant of God, one evolves into an instrument of God. To use the classic simile, one is a string, the harp of life played by God. One gives out those notes as an instrument, as the divine wants. As the identification as an instrument grows, one has no separate existence even as an instrument. One becomes just a slave of God. What God wills, that is reflected without an instrumentation. There is an immediacy of union. There is no gulf as between a master and a servant, or between something that impels and an instrument that transmits. There is, at the level of work, a complete identity between the master and the seeker. Similarly, in the yoga of love, knowledge, narrow conceptions, philosophical formulas, they turn out to be absolutely inadequate. After all, as Sri Aurobindo points out, how can the human tongue in its poor speech speak of those ineffable sweetnesses, those innumerable touches of love supreme, the divine Godhead, the divine lover? He reveals himself in a thousand ways. One never knows how he shall come or where he will be seen. It may be that when you look round in the universe, you have the sight of an ideal face, a heroic mold, and something catches. You look at a beautiful building, a temple tower, or the blue sea, anywhere, or a beautiful carved image, any object of beauty becomes first an object of carved, cup of carved delight and hooks you to the divinity that is trying to express itself. The divine Godhead reveals itself as a master, as a friend and comrade who shares your joys and your pains. Your charioteer, the charioteer of your carriage of life, chariot of life, guiding you, comforting you, surprising you at all odd moments with his glory. One never knows where one stumbles upon the Godhead when one has the love, heart of love for God. One may not be aware on the surface that the divine love is waiting to manifest. One may be lost in petty activities. One may be lost in the pursuit of human love, but very often it has happened and it is happening that human love, after a certain point, turns itself into a gate opening on the vastnesses of the divine love. Many of you have not heard of the real life story of one of the celebrated saints of India, Tulsidas. He's a poor man, a Brahmin, a learned Brahmin, as all Brahmins were in those innumerable days. He was very fond of his wife. His head was always loaded with scriptures. He could solve the most intricate and profound problems of philosophical casuistry. But he was completely attached to his wife. He loved her more than anything else. He spoke of Rama, but he loved his wife. Once when his wife had gone to her mother's house across the river, at night, this Tulsi could not contain himself. He wanted to get by the side of his wife. And it has been recorded how he swam miles after miles of that river at midnight when it was pouring torrents. And he reached the house of his wife. But she was on the upper story. And he did not know how to get in. The doors were closed. And in that darkness, he found a long rope which he held with his hands and ascended and jumped into the window. His wife got up thinking that it must be some thief or someone. And she was aghast that in this weather, this man has come in search of her. And she asked him, how did you come? Then he said, I came like this, there was a rope. She looked, there was no rope, it was a serpent. Then she was moved and she said, Tulsi, if you had loved your Rama with half the love that you are bestowing on me, you would have realized him. It caught him. He shot like an arrow. And he bolted out of the same window and went ahead, never to turn back. And he has been today celebrated as the foremost devotee of Lord Rama, who, as you know, was an incarnation of the Supreme Godhead. Many have been the stories and legends of how the Lord, the Divine Beloved, reveals himself spurring humanity, not only as a friend, not only as a comrade, but there have been instances where he reveals himself as an enemy. His first approach is that of an enemy. One hates, and in the very process of hating, one concentrates all one's consciousness on that object of hatred, and that object suddenly reveals itself to be the divine love. There are 1,000 gates and one more to the divine beloved. He is not only the pursued, he is also the pursuer. I do not know how many of you have read of the Hound of Heaven, where there is a vivid and Hound of Heaven, graphic description of how the grace of God pursues man, pursues the soul through all its alleys, through all its erring detours, and catches him. In Sanskrit, the word for grace is anugraha, which, as all Sanskrit words, lend themselves to be analyzed, and their meaning dissected. The word for grace, anugraha, means that which pursues and holds. Man may try to run away from grace, but the grace being what it is, it pursues and catches a person in its hook from which there is no escape. Of course, it is a question how many lives it takes for being caught by the hook of grace. Those of us who have been fortunate in breathing the sunshine of personal grace of God can have no conception. I was saying that the grace of God pursues, that man pursues God is one side of the matter. The other side, and the more true side, is that the grace of God, the love of God, pursues man. It is because of love, God loves, that man is able at all to love God. Otherwise man will always be lost in his petty preoccupations of egoistic persuasion. Because there is a constant tapping from within, there is a constant downpour of grace from above, whether we are aware of it or not, that one day we wake up to this fact of love and then wonder how at all we could have failed to notice the presence of God everywhere, failed to sense the flow of God's love in our veins. Such is divine love. And the crown of this love is liberation. Not salvation, not individual salvation somewhere into a beyond, but a liberation into a state of union with God, with the Beloved. And this union of love includes in itself the all other unions that are achievable by the other paths of knowledge, works and other ways. When there is absolute union between the human soul and the Divine Beloved, between the seeker and the Lord, there is automatically a closeness, what is called samipya, salokya. There are different types of mukti, liberation into like world, liberation into nearness. Similarly, there is so much of identity, each reflects the other. At times it is difficult to say who is human and who is divine. There is such a likeness between the adorer and the adored. There is what is called in Sanskrit sadrishya, the likeness. This is another type of mukti. All these, the liberation into likeness, the liberation into proximity, the liberation of sharing of the same world, these are constituent parts of the absolute union attainable by the divine love. That is why Sri Aurobindo says that the divine love is the secret of secrets, is the mystery of mysteries. Ask something? There is nobody else today? Obviously, his activity of persecution of those devoted to Christ was his last resistance, his way of fighting the grace that was coming to him. He may not be fully aware at the conscious level of his mind, but he was the chosen. But the ignorant part of him was fighting it to save itself from being engulfed by the divine consciousness. Usually such intense hatred, intense things, they are the last convulsive movements of a dying resistance. Indian mythology is full of these incidents. And of course, with typical exaggeration common to the Puranas, some devotees have deliberately chosen to be born as enemies of God rather than devotees, because they said that way their salvation will be quicker because God will pay more attention to them, you see. And when they are disarmed, the truth behind these stories is, when evil or falsehood presents itself in one place in its extreme form, it calls forth a radical way of elimination from the divine. It is not allowed to work its way out. It is struck off the cosmic lists. It is only a way of saying that even when we see the maximization of evil, lurking there is the solution. It is deliberately allowed to gather itself so that at one blow it can be eliminated. We have seen even medical science speaks of things and poisons being allowed to form themselves into certain boils, isn't it? Certain diseases of that type, so that the whole system may be rid of it. Ultimately, from this point of view, the divine love is at the bottom of all movements. The whole movement of evolution of earth from inconscience, from the state of unconsciousness onward, has been possible because of that single ray of love which came straight from the Supreme in answer to this creation which got involved in complete darkness of nations as the nadir of devolution. And it is that love which sees to it that despite of all deformations and perversions, the movement is Godward. Even the so-called atheists, agnostics, they also serve the divine love without knowing it. They won't admit it. Perhaps you know that when China attacked India and Mother went in her subtle body to see what could be done to stop the war and increase the pressure of the forces of peace and harmony, she saw that all were closed to the divine vibrations. And the only people who are receptive to the divine suggestion were the Chinese. And it is on record that nobody will be ever able to explain why the Chinese chose to go back in their hour of victory. We can give any explanation, but the fact is they were open, because they had no specially built-in formulations. That is the character of love. It acts whether the recipient is aware of it or not, whether the recipient responds or not. To expect return, to expect reception, these are the characteristics of human love, not divine love. Today, as we said earlier, we will start in a general way with the teachings of the mother. On alternate Saturdays we will have synthesis. Now it will be here after the yoga of self-perfection. So one Saturday the mother's teachings, and the another yoga of self-perfection. Those of you who care to read anything before they come to the to our meeting here, I would suggest that you read the first one or two chapters of the Conversations with the Mother or Words of the Mother first series. So the main themes of those chapters shall form the subject of our talk next Saturday.